These were usually the magic words.
You're welcome to put it on reserve if you like.
She turned her coiffed gray head away from me as if she wanted to get back to her work. Maybe one of my students has checked it out to read ahead for the course. If you just let me have his name, I'll get in touch with him myself. She looked narrowly at me.
We don't usually do that.
This is an unusual situation, I'll be frank with you. I really must use one section of that book to prepare my exam for them, and, well, I loaned my own copy to a student, and he's unable to find it now. It was my mistake, but you know how these things go with students. I should have known better. Her face softened, and she looked almost sympathetic.
It's terrible, isn't it? We lose a stack of books every term, I'm sure. Well, let me see if I can get the name for you, but don't spread around that I did this, all right?
She turned away to root in a cabinet behind her, and I stood reflecting on the duplicity I had suddenly discovered in my own nature. When had I learned to lie so fluently? It gave me a feeling of uneasy pleasure. While I was standing there, I realized that another librarian behind the big altar had moved closer and was watching me. He was a thin, middle-aged man I'd often seen there. Perhaps because I'd noticed him before, I was unexpectedly struck by a change in his appearance. His face looked sallow and wasted, perhaps even seriously ill. He spoke suddenly, as if he suspected I might steal something from the desk if I weren't attended to at once.
Can I help you?
Oh, no, thank you. I waved at the lady librarian's back. I'm being helped already.
I see.
He stepped aside as she returned with a slip of paper and put it in front of me. At that moment, I didn't know where to look. The paper swam under my eyes. For as the second librarian turned aside, he leaned over to examine some books that had been returned to the desk and were waiting to be dealt with. And as he bent myopically toward them, his neck was exposed for a moment above the threadbare shirt collar, and I saw on it two scabbed, grimy-looking wounds. Then he straightened and turned away again, holding his books.
Is this what you wanted?
I looked down at the paper she pushed toward me.
You see, it's the slip for Bram Stoker, Dracula. We have just one copy.
The grubby male librarian suddenly dropped a book on the floor, and the sound of it reverberated with a bang through the high nave. He straightened and looked directly at me, and I have never seen, or until that moment I had never seen, a human gaze so full of hatred and wariness. Thanks very much. I walked off, feeling those sharp eyes boring into my back. I went purposefully out the front door. Outside, I found a bench in the brightest possible sunlight. It was all too much to digest quickly, however. In that dazed moment, I had taken in not only my glimpse of the librarian's wounded neck, but also the name of the library patron who had beaten me to Dracula. Her name was Helen Rossi. I picked up my briefcase and hurried to a public phone booth near the student commons. University information, please. No one had followed me here, as far as I could see, but I closed the door and through it kept a sharp eye on the passers-by. Do you have a listing for a Miss Helen Rossi? Yes, graduate student. The university operator was laconic. I could hear her shuffling slowly through papers.
We have an H. Rossi listed in the woman's graduate dormitory.
That's it. Thank you so much. I scribbled the number down and dialed again. A matron answered, her voice sharp and protective.
Miss Rossi. Yes? Who's calling, please?
Oh, God. I hadn't thought ahead to this. Her brother. She told me she'd be at this number. I could hear footsteps leaving the phone. A sharper stride returning, the rustle of a hand taking the receiver.
Thank you, Miss Lewis.
Then she spoke into my ear, and I heard the low, strong tone I remembered from the library. It sounded like a warning, not a mere statement of fact.
I do not have a brother. Who is this?
My father rubbed his hands together in the chill wind, making the sleeves of his rain jacket crinkle like tissue paper. Helen, I thought, although I did not dare repeat the name aloud. It was a name I had always liked. It evoked for me something valiant and beautiful, like the Pre-Raphaelite frontispiece showing Helen of Troy in my children's book of the Iliad, which I had owned at home in the U.S. Above all, it had been my mother's name, and she was a topic my father never discussed.
The diner I'd chosen was far enough from campus to make me feel out of range of that creepy librarian, and yet close enough to be a reasonable request, not the assignation in some lonely spot that an axe murderer might take with a woman he hardly knew. Helen was there before me. When I pushed in through the diner door, I saw her unwinding her blue silk scarf in a far corner and taking off her white gloves. Her hair was rolled back almost smoothly and pinned away from her face, so that when she turned to regard me, I had a sense of being stared at even more enormously than at the library table the day before.
Good morning. I have ordered you some coffee, since you sounded so fatigued on the phone.
I introduced myself by name this time and shook hands with her, trying to hide my uneasiness. I wanted to ask her immediately about her own last name, but I thought I'd better wait for the right opportunity. I pulled out a chair opposite her and sat down.
Why did I think I would be hearing from you again?
Her tone was close to insulting. I discovered something odd this morning. That's why I called you out of the blue. She was quick, but I was quicker, since I'd been waiting for the flinch, the drop in color under her already pale face. Have you still got that copy of Dracula from the library?
Yes. Whose business is it what another person checks out from the library?
I ignored this bait. Did you tear out all the cards in the card catalog pertaining to that book? This time her reaction was genuine and undisguised.
Did I what?
This morning I went to the card catalog to look for some information on the subject we both seemed to be studying. I found that all the cards for Dracula and Stoker had been wrenched out of the drawer. Her face had tightened and she was staring at me, the ugliness very close to the surface now, her eyes too bright. But at that moment, for the first time since Massimo had shouted to me that Rossi had disappeared, I felt an infinitesimal lightening of burdens, a shifting of the weight of loneliness. Her words came slowly as if laying down a weapon and preparing to talk.
The cards were there yesterday morning.
The diner's indifferent waiter was setting coffee on the table, and Helen drew hers toward her without looking at it. Someone obviously doesn't want you, me, anybody, checking out that book. I kept my voice quiet, watching her.
That's the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard.
She put sugar in her cup and stirred it. But she looked unconvinced by her own words, and I pressed on. Do you still have the book? Her spoon fell in with an annoyed clatter.
Yes. It is in my book bag.
She glanced down, and I noticed beside her the briefcase I'd seen her carrying the day before. Miss Rossi, I beg your pardon, and I'm afraid I'm going to sound like a maniac, but it's my personal belief that there may be some danger to you in possessing this book, which someone else clearly doesn't want you to have.
What makes you think that?
A slight flush had spread over her cheekbones again, and she looked down into her cup. I wondered with horror if she might not be in league with the vampire. Dracula's bride, I thought, aghast. The Sunday matinee is coming back to me in rapid frames. That smoky dark hair would fit, and the rich, unidentifiable accent. I put this idea firmly out of my mind. Do you actually know someone who wouldn't want you to have that book?
Yes, as a matter of fact. But that is certainly none of your business.
She glared at me and went back to her coffee.
Why were you hunting for the book anyway?
I needed that book very badly myself, so I went to the library to see if they had a second copy I might be able to use.
Are you trying to intimidate me out of my library book?
Her tone was a little softened now, and I caught the amusement that made her strong mouth twitch.
I believe you are.
No, I'm not. But I would like to know who you think might not want you checking out this book. I set down my cup and looked across at her. She moved her shoulders restlessly under the lightweight wool of her jacket. She appeared to be making up her mind to say something.
Who are you?
I took the question at academic face value. I'm a graduate student here, in history.
History?
It was a quick, almost angry interjection. I'm writing my dissertation on Dutch trade in the 17th century.
Oh. I am an anthropologist. But I am also very much interested in history. I study the customs and traditions of the Balkans and Central Europe, especially of my native Romania.
It was my turn to flinch. Really, this was all more and more peculiar. Is that why you wanted to read Dracula? Her smile surprised me. White, even, her teeth a little small for such a strong face, the eyes shining. Then she tightened her lips again.
I suppose you could say that.
You're not answering my questions.
Why should I? You are a total stranger and you want to take my library book.
You may be in danger, Miss Rossi. I'm not trying to threaten you, but I'm perfectly serious. Her eyes narrowed on mine.
You are hiding something, too. I will tell you if you tell me.
I had never seen, met, or spoken with a woman like this. She was combative without being in the least flirtatious. I had the sensation that her words were a pool of cold water, into which I now plunged without stopping to count the consequences. I borrowed her tone. All right. You answer my question first. Who do you think might not want you to have that book in your possession?
Professor Bartholomew Rossi. You're in history. Maybe you've heard of him.
I sat there dumbfounded. Professor Rossi? What do you mean?
I have answered your question.
She straightened up, adjusted her jacket, and piled her gloves one on the other again as if finished with a task. I wondered fleetingly if she were enjoying the effect her words had on me, seeing me stammer over them.
Now, tell me what you mean by all this melodrama about danger from a book.
Miss Rossi, please. I will tell you, whatever I can, but please explain to me your relation to Professor Bartholomew Rossi. She bent down, opened her book bag, and took out a leather case.
Do you mind if I smoke? I guess the loneliness of this place is affecting me. I have hardly spoken with anyone in 2 months, except about work.
I could hear her accent welling up fully under the words, which she spoke with a soft rancor.
But if you will keep your promise.
The hard look came over her again. She straightened, cigarette jutting defiantly from one hand.
My relationship to the famous Professor Rossi is very simple. Or it should be. He is my father. He met my mother while he was in Romania looking for Dracula.
My coffee splashed across the table, over my lap, down the front of my shirt.
So this really shocks you. You must know him, then.
I do. He's my advisor. But he never told me about Romania, and he never told me he had a family.
He doesn't.
The coldness in her voice cut through me.
I have never met him, you see. Although I guess it is only a matter of time now.
I had made a soggy heap of napkins, and now I pushed everything aside. Heap, coffee cup, spoon. Why?
He met my mother in her village, enjoyed her company for a while, and left her after a few weeks with an address in England. After he had gone, my mother discovered she was pregnant. And then her sister, who lived in Hungary, helped her flee to Budapest before I was born.
He never told me he'd been to Romania. I was croaking, not speaking. She smoked bitterly.
Not surprising. My mother wrote him from Hungary to the address he'd left her and told him about their baby.
Her eyes bored into me, huge and starkly black now. What year were you born?
1931. My mother took me to Romania for a few days once, while I was at the university. But even then she would not go back to her village.
My God. I whispered it to the Formica tabletop. My God, I thought he told me everything, but he didn't tell me that.
He told you? What?
Why haven't you met him? Doesn't he know you're here? She looked at me strangely, but answered without demurring.
It's a game, I guess you could say. Just a fancy of mine. Of course, my mother told me my paternal heritage, and we do know Professor Rossi's outstanding books even in the murky depths of the East Bloc. It wasn't exactly hard to find out where he was either, you know. I used to stare at the university named on the jackets of his books and vow to go there one day. I thought things through. I made all the right connections politically. And when the time came, I had my pick of scholarships. I got my fellowship to come here only 4 months ago. Isn't it a pretty picture? The long-lost daughter turns out to be a great credit, finds her father. Happy reunion.
The bitterness in her smile turned my stomach.
But that is not quite what I had in mind. I have come here to let him hear about me, as if by accident, my publications, my lectures. We will see if he can hide from his past then. Ignore me as he ignored my mother. And about this Dracula thing.
She pointed her cigarette at me.
My mother, bless her simple soul for thinking of it, told me something about that.
Told you what?
Told me about Rossi's special research on the subject. I had not known about it. Not until last summer, just before I left for London. That is how they met. He was asking around in the village about vampire lore. He was in Romania looking for information on Vlad the Impaler, our own dear Count Dracula. And don't you think it's strange that he has not published a thing on the subject? Why should he not have published anything out of this very unusual research?
Why?
I'll tell you. Because he is saving it up for a grand finale. It is his secret, his passion. Why else would a scholar remain silent? But he has a surprise coming to him. You would not believe how much ground I have covered in a year since I learned about this little interest of his. What a shame it will be for him when someone else publishes the definitive work on the subject first. Someone with his own name, too. It is beautiful.
My father looked around him like a man in a dream. We were in Athens now, on the Acropolis. I was surprised to find the most distant view on the horizon was of mountains, long dry ridges that hung darkly over the city at this sunset hour. As we started back to the hotel, and he came out of his reverie to ask how I liked the great panorama, it took me a minute to collect my thoughts and answer. I'd gone into my father's room a little later than usual so that he could look through my algebra homework, and I found him writing, mulling over the day's paperwork as he often did in the evening. That night he sat very still with his head bent above the desk, drooping toward some documents, not upright and paging through them with his usual efficiency. His form cast a great shadow on the undecorated hotel room wall. The figure of a man slumped dully over another, darker desk. If I hadn't known his fatigue and the familiar shape of his shoulders sloping above the page, I might for a second have said he was dead. Triumphal clear weather, the days enormous as a mountain sky, followed us with spring into Slovenia. I hadn't been back to the Julian Alps since our visit to Emona 2 years before. When I asked if we'd have time to see that city again, my father said hurriedly that we'd be far too busy, staying at a great lake north of Emona for his conference, and then rushing back to Amsterdam before I fell behind in school. Lake Bled, when we arrived, was no disappointment. It had poured into an alpine valley at the end of one of the ice ages, and provided early nomads there with a resting place in thatched houses out on the water. Now it lay like a sapphire in the hands of the Alps, its surface burnished with white caps in the late afternoon breeze. From one steep edge rose a cliff higher than the rest, and on this one of Slovenia's great castles roosted, restored by the tourist bureau in unusually good taste. Its crenellations looked down on an island, where a specimen of those modest red-roofed churches of the Austrian type floated like a duck, and boats went out to the island every few hours. On the morning of the third day, we took a little bus around the lake, riding nearly to the level of the castle, and then dismounted to walk to the summit. The castle was made of brown stones like discolored bone, joined neatly together after some long state of dilapidation. When we came through the first passageway to a chamber of state, I gasped. Through a leaded window, the surface of the lake shone 1,000 feet below, stretching white in the sunlight. The castle seemed to be clinging to the edge of the precipice with only its toes dug in for support. My father told me at breakfast the next morning that he wanted to sit still for 2 or 3 days. It was hard for me to picture him actually sitting still, but I could see dark rings under his eyes, and I liked the idea of his having a rest. I couldn't help feeling that something had happened to him, that he was burdened by some silent new anxiety. but he told me only that he was longing again for the Adriatic beaches. We took an express train south through stations whose names were posted in both Latin and Cyrillic letters, then through stations whose names were posted in Cyrillic only. We were moving south again, and the land mellowed to gold and green as we hurried through it, then rose up into rocky gray mountains, then dropped on our left to a shimmering sea. My father sighed deeply, but with satisfaction, not the fatigued little gasp he gave more and more often these days. In a busy market town, we left the train, and my father rented a car to drive us along the folded complexities of the coast road. The town where we parked was right on the sea. The little harbor there was lined with fishing boats knocking against each other in a translucent surf. My father wanted to stay on a nearby island, and he engaged a boat with a wave to its owner, an old man with a black beret on the back of his head. The air was warm, even this late in the afternoon, and the spray that reached my fingertips was fresh but not cold. I leaned out of the bow, feeling like a figurehead. "Careful," my father said, gathering the back of my sweater in his hand. The boatman was steering us close to an island port now, an old village with an elegant stone church. He slung a rope round a stump of pier and offered me one gnarled hand up out of the boat. My father paid him with some of those colorful socialist bills, and he touched his beret. As he was clambering back to his seat, he turned.
"Your girl, daughter?"
"Yes."
"I bless her."
The man spoke simply and carved a cross in the air near me.
Helen Rossi sat there looking at me with an expression of bitter pleasure. Could this woman, I asked myself slowly, with her legacy of resentment and her scholarly vendetta against Rossi, have injured him herself, caused his disappearance? "Miss Rossi, your story is extraordinary, but I must tell you something very important." I drew in a deep breath, then another. "I know Professor Rossi quite well. The thing is, I take it from the way you talked about him that you don't realize Professor Rossi, your father, has disappeared." She stared at me, and I couldn't detect any guile in her face, only confusion. So this news was a surprise. The pain over my heart lessened a little.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, 3 nights ago I was talking with him as usual, and by the next day he had vanished. The police are looking for him right now." I recounted briefly the events of that evening, beginning with my bringing him my strange little book, but said nothing about the story Rossi had told me. She looked at me, her face twisted with perplexity.
"Is this some kind of trick you are playing on me?"
"No, not in the least. It really isn't. I've hardly been able to eat or sleep since it happened."
"Don't the police have any idea where he is?"
"None, as far as I can tell." Her look was suddenly shrewd.
"Do you?"
I hesitated. "Possibly. It's a long story, and it seems to be getting longer by the hour." She looked hard at me.
"Wait. When you were reading those letters in the library yesterday, you said they had to do with a problem some professor was having. Did you mean Rossi?"
"Yes. I'm convinced that before he vanished, Rossi believed he was in personal danger." She seemed to be trying to take all of this in, this news of a father she had known for so long only as a symbol of challenge.
"Personal danger? From what?"
I took the plunge. "Rossi, your father is convinced that Dracula still walks the earth." She stared at me. "What do you make of that? Does it seem insane to you?" I waited for her to laugh or stand up and leave as she had in the library.
"It's funny. Normally I'd say that was peasant legend, superstition about the memory of a bloody tyrant. But the strange thing is that my mother is absolutely convinced of the same thing."
"Your mother?"
"Yes. I told you she is a peasant by birth. She has a right to these superstitions, although she is probably less convinced of them than her parents were. But why an eminent Western scholar?"
"Miss Rossi, why don't you read Rossi's letters? I'm giving you my frankest warning that everyone who has handled his papers on this topic has been subjected to some kind of threat, as far as I can tell. But if you aren't afraid, read them for yourself." She seemed to be thinking over this proposal, her chin in her fist.
"All right. You have got me in a vulnerable spot. Of course I cannot resist the temptation to learn more about Father Rossi, especially if it puts me ahead of his research. But if he seems to me merely insane, I warn you that you will not get much sympathy from me.
Her smile was not a smile. Fine. Before we concluded our transaction, however, I had to lie on one point. I'm sorry to say I don't have the letters with me. I was afraid to carry them around today. Actually, I'd been thoroughly afraid to leave them in my apartment, and they were hidden in my briefcase. But I'd be damned, literally, maybe, if I pulled them out in the middle of the diner. I'll have to go home and get them, and I'll have to ask you to read them in my presence. They're fragile and very precious to me.
All right. Can we meet tomorrow afternoon?
That's too late. I'd like you to see them immediately. I'm sorry, I know it sounds odd, but you'll understand my sense of urgency once you've read them. She shrugged.
If it will not take too long.
It won't. Can you meet me at St. Mary's Church? That's on Elm Street, 2 blocks from...
I know where it is.
She gathered her gloves and put them on very neatly. She rewound the blue scarf, which shimmered around the throat like lapis lazuli.
What time?
Give me 30 minutes to get the papers from my apartment and meet you there. St. Mary's Church was a homely little piece of Victoriana that lingered at the edge of the old section of campus. Its dark paneled interior smelled of wax and dusty upholstery. 2 old ladies in hats sprigged with fake flowers were arranging real ones on the carved altar up front. I went in rather awkwardly and settled myself in a back pew, where I could see the doors without being seen at once by anyone who entered. At last the front door swung open, and Helen Rossi stood hesitating for a moment, looked behind her, and then stepped in. Sunlight from the side windows threw turquoise and mauve on her clothes as she stood there. I saw her glance around the carpeted entrance. She came into the nave and then drew back a little, seeing me get to my feet. She whispered, her eyes fixing me accusingly.
Did you bring the letters? I have to return to my department by 1 o'clock.
She glanced around again. What's wrong? My arms prickled with instinctive nervousness. I seemed to have developed some sort of morbid sixth sense over the last 2 days. She spoke in the same low voice.
Someone was following me.
Her face, framed by the roll of heavy dark hair, wore an odd expression, mixed suspicion and bravado.
A small, thin man in shabby clothes. Tweed jacket, green tie.
Are you sure? Where did you see him?
In the card catalogue. Do you know him?
Yes. He's a librarian. I'll tell you more about him later. Come, sit down and be comfortable. Here are the letters. I made room for her in one of the velvet-cushioned pews and opened my briefcase. Immediately her face was intent. She lifted out the package with careful hands and removed the letters almost as reverently as I had the day before. I'll just wander around here and give you whatever time you need. If there's anything I can explain or help you with... She nodded absently, eyes fixed on the first letter, and I walked away. For the next half hour, I examined the carved altar, the paintings in the chapel, the tasseled hangings at the pulpit, the marble figure of the exhausted mother and her squirming baby.
I'm done.
Her voice was low, and she looked pale and tired.
You were right. There is no mention of his affair with my mother, or even of his traveling to Romania. You were telling the truth about that. I cannot understand it. This must have been during the same period, surely the same trip to the continent, because I was born 9 months after that.
I'm sorry. Her dark face hadn't asked for pity, but I felt it. I wish I had some clues for you here, but you see how it is. I can't explain it either.
At least we believe each other, don't we?
She looked directly at me. I was surprised to discover I could feel pleasure in the midst of all this grief and apprehension. What would you advise doing next? Her profile was sharp and thoughtful, close to me in the dim light.
Well... I cannot see that this will help you very much in a modern investigation, but if you were to obey the dictates of Dracula lore, you would have to assume that Rossi has been assaulted and removed by a vampire, who would either kill him or more likely pollute him with the curse of the undead. three attacks that mingle your blood with that of Dracula, or one of his disciples, make you a vampire eternally.
But why would Dracula abduct Rossi? Why not just strike him and corrupt him without making the change noticeable to anyone? She shook her head.
I don't know. It is unusual behavior, according to the folklore. Rossi must be... I mean, if this were all a supernatural occurrence, he must be of special interest to Vlad Dracula. Perhaps even a threat to him somehow.
She folded her gloves carefully in her black-skirted lap.
I wonder if there's not another source of information we're overlooking.
Her mouth drooped. Silently, I thanked her for that we. What's that? She sighed and unfolded the gloves.
My mother.
Your mother? But what would she know about... I had only begun my string of questions when a shift in the light and the breath of a draft made me turn. From where we sat, we could see the church doors without being seen from them, the vantage point from which I'd chosen to watch Helen's entrance. Now a hand inserted itself between the doors, then a bony, pointed face. The strange-looking librarian was peering into the church. I gathered the briefcase and stack of papers silently in one arm, grasped Helen with the other, and drew her from the end of the pew into the side aisle. A door was open there, leading into a small chamber beyond, and we slipped in. I closed it quietly. There was no way to lock it from the inside, I noted with a pang, although it had a big iron-lined keyhole. It was darker in this little room than in the nave. There was a baptismal font in the middle, a cushioned bench or two along the walls. Helen and I looked silently at each other. I handed her the papers and went back to the keyhole. Looking carefully through it, I could see the librarian moving past a column. He did resemble a weasel, his pointed face thrust forward, glancing around at all the pews. He turned in my direction, and I drew back a little. He seemed to study the door to our hiding place, and even took a step or two toward it, then stepped away again. Suddenly, a lavender sweater moved into my field of view. It was one of the altar ladies. I could hear her voice, muffled.
Can I help you?
Well, I'm looking for someone.
The librarian had a sharp, whistling voice, too loud for a sanctuary.
Did you see a young lady come in here, in a black suit, dark hair?
Why, yes.
The kind woman looked around, too.
There was someone by that description here a little while ago. She was with a young man sitting in the back pews, but she's certainly not here now.
The weasel swiveled this way and that.
Couldn't she be hiding in one of those rooms?
He wasn't subtle, that was clear. The lavender lady turned our way, too.
Hiding? I'm sure there's no one hiding in our church. Wouldn't you like me to call the priest? Do you need some help?
Oh, no, no. I must have made a mistake.
Would you like some of our literature?
Oh, no. No, thank you.
He backed down the aisle. I saw him peer around again, and then he passed out of my range of vision. There was a heavy click, a thump, the front door closing behind him. I gave Helen a nod, and she sighed, noiseless relief. But we waited a few more minutes there, glancing at each other over the font. Helen looked down first, her brow furrowed. I knew she must be wondering how on earth she'd gotten into such a situation and what it really meant. The top of her hair was glossy, ebony. She was hatless again today.
He's looking for you.
Maybe he is looking for you.
She indicated the envelope I held. I have a strange idea. Maybe he knows where Rossi is. She frowned again.
None of this makes much sense anyway, so why not?
I can't let you go back to the library, or your room. He'll be looking for you both places.
Let me? I doubt he would be able to follow me to my room unless...
Did she have a sort of dimple on one side of her stern chin, or was that sarcasm?
Unless he can turn himself into a bat already. You see, our matron doesn't allow vampires in our rooms. Or men, for that matter. Besides, I'm hoping he will follow me back to the library.
Hoping? I was startled.
I knew he wouldn't talk with us here. Not in the church. He is probably waiting outside for us. I have a bone to pick with him, because he is trying to interfere with my library privileges, and you believe he has information for you about my... Professor Rossi. Why not let him follow me? We can discuss my mother on the way.
There was no sign of the librarian outside the church. We strolled toward the library. My heart was thumping hard, although Helen looked cool, with twin crucifixes from the church vestibule in our pockets. Take one, leave a quarter. She spoke quietly about 2 blocks from the church.
He is back there. I saw him when we turned the corner. Do not look behind you.
I stifled an exclamation and we walked on.
I am going to go into the upper stacks in the library. The 7th floor. That is the first really quiet area. Do not go up there with me. He is more likely to follow me if I'm alone than to follow you. You are stronger.
At the library doors we parted with a show of cordiality.
Good luck with your research, Mr. Dutch.
Helen shook my hand in her gloved one. And with yours, Miss...
Shh.
She walked off. I retreated into the card catalog stands and pulled out a drawer at random to make myself look busy. Ben-Hur to Benedictine. With my head bent over it, I could still see the circulation desk. Helen was getting a permission slip to enter the stacks. Then I saw the librarian creeping along the other side of the nave, keeping close to the other half of the card catalog. He had reached H by the time Helen moved toward the door of the stacks. In a moment, Helen's dark figure had vanished up the iron stairs. The librarian lingered for a minute at G, then groped for something in his jacket pocket, flashed a card, and disappeared. I hurried to the circulation desk and through the doorway, and put a cautious foot on the stairway looking up. On each floor you could see up one level through the metal steps, but no farther. No sign of the librarian above me. No sound. By the 4th floor I began to feel really worried. It was too quiet. I should never have let Helen use herself as bait on this mission. I suddenly remembered Rossi's story about his friend Hedges, and it made me quicken my pace. On the 6th floor I could hear footsteps above me, and on the 7th, history, I paused, unsure how to enter the stacks without giving my presence away. After a moment, I picked up muffled conversation from a corner of the stacks. I crept toward it, treading as quietly as I could. Then I caught Helen's voice. I was sure it was Helen's. And then an unpleasant scraping voice that must be the librarian's. My heart turned over. They were in the medieval section. I knew it well, now, and I got close enough to hear their words, although I couldn't risk looking around the end of the next stack. They seemed to be on the other side of the shelves to my right.
Is that correct?
The scraping little voice came again.
You have no right poking around in those books, young lady.
Why do you want them so badly? Does it have something to do with Professor Rossi, perhaps?
Cowering behind English feudalism, I wasn't sure whether to cringe or to cheer aloud. Whatever Helen thought of all this, she was at least intrigued.
Professor, who? I don't know what you mean.
I'll tell you what. If you can tell me something about Professor Rossi, maybe I could share with you a little map I saw recently.
The map? You have Rossi's map? I'll kill you for that map!
A gasp from Helen. Then a cry and a thump.
Put that down!
My feet didn't touch the ground until I was on top of him. His little head hit the floor with a thump that rattled my brains, too. Helen crouched next to me. She was very white, but looked calm. She was holding up her 25-cent silver crucifix from the church, keeping it trained on him as he fought and spat under me. The librarian was frail, and for a few minutes I could more or less pin him down. Lucky for me, since I spent the last 3 years turning through brittle Dutch documents, not lifting weights. He flailed in my grasp, and I brought my knee down on his legs.
Rossi, that's not fair. I should have gone instead. It was my turn. Give me the map.
He began to sob, a pitiful, ugly sound. Where's Rossi? Tell us this instant where he is. Did you hurt him?
I didn't touch him. I don't know anything about it!
Oh, yes, you do.
Helen bent closer. Her expression was fierce, but she was very white, and I noticed now that she had held her free hand tightly over her neck. Helen! She waved me away.
Where is Rossi?
Rossi didn't want to go. I wanted to. It wasn't fair. He took Rossi instead of me. He took him by force. I would have gone willingly to serve him, to help him.
He suddenly clamped his mouth shut. What? I thumped his head slightly on the floor for good measure. Who took Rossi? Are you keeping him somewhere? Helen held the cross right over his nose, and he began to sob again.
My master.
Helen, next to me, drew a long breath and sat back on her heels, as if recoiling involuntarily from his words. Who is your master? I dug my knee into his leg. Where did he take Rossi? His eyes blazed.
To the tomb!
Maybe my grip had weakened, or maybe his confession made him suddenly strong. In any case, he suddenly freed one hand, swung around like a scorpion, and bent my wrist backward where it held down his shoulder. The pain was unbearably sharp, and I jerked my arm back in fury. He was gone before I could understand what had happened, and I took off after him. But I was hampered by my briefcase, which I still clutched in one hand. Even in that first moment of pursuit, I realized fleetingly I hadn't wanted to drop it, or throw it to Helen. She had told him about the map. She was a traitor, and he had bitten her if only for a moment. Wouldn't she be tainted herself now? For the first and last time, I ran through the hushed nave of the library instead of walking, only half seeing the astonished faces that turned toward me as I flew along. I thrust open the heavy front door, then stopped short on the steps. The afternoon light blinded me as if I, too, had been living in an underworld. On the street in front of the library, several cars had stopped. Traffic was at a halt, in fact, and a girl in a waitress uniform was crying on the sidewalk, pointing at something. Someone was shouting, and a couple of men knelt by the front tire of one of the stopped cars. The weaselly librarian's legs stuck out from under the car, twisted at an impossible angle. One of his arms was flung over his head. He lay face down on the pavement in a little blood, asleep forever.
My father was reluctant to take me to Oxford. He would be there 6 days, he said, a long time for me to miss school again. I was surprised that he was willing to leave me at home. He hadn't done that even once since I'd found the Dragon Book. I pointed out that our trip along the Yugoslav coast had taken almost 2 weeks, without any sign of detriment to my schoolwork. My father wavered visibly. He said his work would prevent him from showing me around properly this time, and he didn't want to spoil my first impressions of Oxford by keeping me cooped up somewhere. I said I preferred being cooped up in Oxford to being cooped up at home with Mrs. Clay. Just as I could not tell him aloud that I couldn't bear to let him, with his dark-circled eyes and the fatigued stoop of shoulder and head, out of my sight now, he could not counter aloud that he might not be safe in Oxford, and that therefore I might not be safe with him. At Oxford, my father was to speak at a conference on political relations between the U.S. and Eastern Europe, now in the full flower of a thaw. Because the university was hosting the conference, we were invited to stay in private rooms in the house of one of the college masters. When we entered the college courtyard, I caught my breath. Around us lay flagstones of the softest worn slate, interrupted here and there by heavy shade trees, serious, melancholy old trees with the occasional bench underneath. A rectangle of perfect grass and a narrow pool of water lay at the feet of the college's main building. It was one of Oxford's oldest, endowed by Edward III in the 13th century, its newest additions shaped by Elizabethan architects. We made our way to the porter's office just inside, and from there to a suite of rooms adjoining the master's house. Master James turned out to be a hearty, kind-spoken man with graying hair and a knobby scar on one cheekbone. I liked his warm handshake and the expression of his large, rather protuberant hazel eyes. He seemed to find nothing strange about my accompanying my father to the conference, and went so far as to suggest that I tour the college with his student assistant that afternoon. I turned up eagerly at 3 o'clock, my new beret in one hand and a notebook in the other. My guide was a pale-haired, gangly undergraduate, whom Master James introduced as Stephen Barley. I liked Stephen's fine blue-veined hands and heavy fisherman's sweater. Jumper, he called it when I admired it aloud. It gave me a feeling of temporary acceptance into that elite community to stroll across the quad at his side. It also gave me my first faint quaver of sexual belonging, the elusive feeling that if I slipped my hand into his as we walked along, a door would fall open somewhere in the long wall of reality as I knew it, never to be closed again. He took me into the dining hall, a high-ceilinged, Tudor-beamed barn full of wooden tables, and showed me where a young Earl of Rochester had cut something rude into a bench while dining there. Above the bench was a scene in a leaded window I couldn't figure out. A man with a cross around his neck, and a stick in one hand bending over what looked like a bundle of black rags.
Oh, that's a curiosity indeed. We're very proud of that. You see, this man is a don from the early years of the college, driving his silver stake through the heart of a vampire.
I stared at him, speechless for a moment. Were there vampires in Oxford in those days?
I don't know about that. But there's a tradition that the early scholars of the college helped protect the countryside around here from vampires. Actually, they collected quite a bit of lore on vampires. Quaint stuff. And you can still see it in the Radcliffe camera across the way.
Could I see the vampire lore? He looked amused.
You like scary stuff, eh? All right.
As we hurried across the traffic, Stephen took my hand, pulling me along to safety. He might have been someone's peremptory big brother, I thought, but the touch of that dry, warm palm sent a tingling signal into mine. The Radcliffe camera, as every Anglophile knows, is one of the great charms of English architecture. Beautiful and odd, a huge barrel of books. We made our way in very quietly, although a talkative tour group filled the center of the glorious round interior. I kept looking around, thinking, what a strange repository this was for evil lore. At last, he led me toward a staircase, and we climbed up to the balcony. He motioned toward a doorway in the wall, cut, as it were, into a sheer cliff face of books.
Over here. There's a little reading room in there. I've been up here just once, but I think that's where they keep the vampire collection.
The dim room was indeed tiny, and hushed, too, set far back from the voices of tourists below. August volumes crowded the shelves, their bindings caramel-colored and brittle as old bone. Among them, a human skull in a little gilded glass case attested to the collection's morbid nature. The chamber was so small, in fact, that there was just space in the center for one reading desk, which we almost stumbled against as we stepped in. That meant that we were suddenly face to face with a scholar who sat there, turning over leaves of a brittle folio and making rapid notes on a pad of paper. He was a pale, rather gaunt man. His eyes were dark hollows, startled and urgent, but also full of absorption as he glanced up from his work. It was my father.
In the confusion of ambulances, police cars, and spectators that accompanied the dead librarian's removal from the street in front of the library, I stood frozen for a minute. It was horrible, unthinkable that even the most unpleasant man's life should have ended so suddenly there. But my next concern was for Helen. The crowd was gathering fast, and I pushed here and there looking for her. I was infinitely relieved when she found me first, tapping me on the shoulder from behind with her gloved hand. She looked pale, but composed. "He hurt you." I tried not to gesture publicly at her neck. "Did he?"
"Yes."
For a minute her lips seemed to tremble, as if she might cry.
"He did not draw much blood. There was no time. And it hurts very little."
"But you..." I was stammering, unbelieving.
"I do not think there will be any infection."
The pain in her face suddenly made my heart twist within me. Then I remembered her betrayal of the secret of the map.
"But why did you—"
"I could not think of any other bait for the creature, and I wanted to see his reaction. I would not have given him the map or any more information. I promise you that."
I studied her suspiciously. Her face was serious, her mouth drawn down into a grim curve. "No?"
I give you my word. Besides, I'm not necessarily in the habit of sharing what I can use for myself, are you?
I had to let that pass, but something in her face did calm my fears.
What will you do now?
I hadn't quite planned my answer before it came out. Go to Istanbul. I'm convinced there's at least one document there that Rossi never had the chance to examine, and that it might contain information about a tomb, perhaps Dracula's tomb at Lake Snagov. I sighed and extended my hand. Miss Rossi, thank you for putting up with a harmless lunatic for a couple of days. If I come back safely, I will certainly let you know. I mean, maybe if I bring your father back safely.
Goodbye. I wish you the best possible luck with your research.
She turned away in the crowd. I turned away, too, and started down the steps and across the quadrangle. 100 feet from the library, I stopped and looked back, hoping to glimpse her dark-suited figure among the ambulance watchers. To my surprise, she was hurrying toward me, already almost on my heels. She reached me quickly. Her expression was urgent.
I have been thinking.
She stopped. She seemed to take a deep breath. Her gaze was direct, challenging.
This concerns my life more than any other thing. I am not quite sure how to do it, but I think I will come with you.
My father had some pleasant excuses for being in the Oxford Vampire Collection instead of at his meeting. The meeting had been cancelled, he said, shaking Stephen Barley's hand with his customary warmth. His gratitude for Stephen's presence was palpable. After all, what could my father have said to me if I'd surprised him there by myself? How could he have explained, or even casually closed the folio under his hand? He did it now, but too late. I had already seen a chapter title, stark on thick ivory paper, Vampires de Provence et des Pyrénées. I slept poorly that night in the canopied chintz bed at the college master's house, waking from strange dreams every few hours. Near dawn, when a slate-colored haze was starting to show through the net curtains, I woke for the last time. This time it was the silence that awakened me. I climbed down from my big bed and dressed and slung a towel over my shoulder. I would wash in the bathroom basin and listen a bit for my father's nocturnal breathing while I was at it. I knocked gently at the bathroom door to be sure he wasn't inside. The silence was even deeper once I was there in front of the mirror drying my face. I put an ear to his door. There was no stir inside. We had for years left each other's privacy intact, but now, in that gray morning light from the bathroom window, I turned the door handle. The room was empty. I let out my indrawn breath. He had gone outside, gone walking alone, probably needing solitude and time for reflection, but something made me switch on the light by the bed to look around more carefully. In the circle of brightness lay a note addressed to me, and on the note rested two objects that took me by surprise, a small silver crucifix on a sturdy chain and a head of fresh garlic. The stark reality of these items made my stomach turn over, even before I read my father's words.
My dear daughter, I am terribly sorry to surprise you like this, but I've been called away on some new business and didn't want to disturb you during the night. I'll be gone just a few days, I hope. I've arranged with Master James to get you safely home in the company of our young friend Stephen Barley. He's been excused from classes for 2 days and will see you to Amsterdam this evening. Don't worry about my absence. It's a confidential matter, but I'll be home as quickly as possible and will explain then. In the meantime, I ask you from the bottom of my heart to wear the crucifix at all times and to carry some of the garlic in each of your pockets. I beg you from a father's heart not to disregard my wishes on this point.
I quickly fastened the chain around my neck and divided the garlic to put in the pockets of my dress. Whatever his errand was, it could not be a simple diplomatic mission, or he would have told me as much. I had known him to leave with little warning to attend a crisis on the other side of Europe, but he always told me where he was going. This time, my racing heart told me he hadn't departed on business. Besides, he was supposed to be here in Oxford this week, giving lectures and attending meetings. He was not one to break an obligation lightly. Then there was that scene yesterday in the Radcliffe camera. My father deep in... What had he been reading, exactly? The master was very kind when I appeared with my suitcase packed and my raincoat over my arm. I explained to him that I was fully ready to travel by myself. I assured him I was grateful for his offer of a student to see me home, across the whole channel, and that I would never forget his kindness. Master James was certain I was capable of traveling alone. I looked like an independent lass, to be sure. It was just that he couldn't go back on his word to my father, an old friend. I was my father's most priceless treasure, and he couldn't ship me off without proper protection. Stephen Barley materialized before I could argue more, or even fully register the idea that the master was my father's old friend when I'd believed they'd met just 2 days ago.
You're on the job yet, my lad. I want a call from Amsterdam as soon as you're there, and I want to talk with the housekeeper. Here's money for your tickets and some meals, and you'll bring me back your receipts. That's not to say you can't get a little Dutch chocolate for yourself at the station. Fetch me a bar, too. It's not as good as Belgian, but it'll do. Off with you now, and use your head. And you, my dear. Goodbye. Come again and see us when you're thinking of university for yourself.
Outside the office, Stephen grabbed my bag for me.
Let's go, then. We've tickets for the 10:30, but we might as well get a head start.
The master and my father had taken care of every detail, I noted, and I wondered what extra chains I'd have to slip at home. I had other business for now, however. Stephen?
Call me Barley.
All right. His smile was just as contagious today. Barley, could I ask you a favor before we leave? He nodded. I'd just like to go to the camera one more time. It was so beautiful, And I'd like to see the vampire collection. I didn't really get to look at it. He groaned.
Well, I could tell you like grisly stuff. Seems to run in your family.
The camera was quiet this morning, nearly empty, and we hurried up a polished staircase to the macabre niche where we'd surprised my father the day before. I swallowed a threat of tears as we entered the tiny room. Hours ago, my father had been sitting here, that strangely distant look veiling his eyes, and now I didn't even know where he was. I remembered where he'd shelved the book, though, replaced it so casually as we talked. It would be below the case with the skull to the left. I ran a finger along the edge of the shelf. Barley watched with frank curiosity. Where the book should have been was a gap like a missing tooth. I froze. Surely my father would never, ever steal a book, so who could have taken it? But a second later, I recognized the volume a hand's length away. Someone had certainly moved it since I'd been there last. Had my father returned for a second look? I lifted the book down very carefully. There was the tall, bone-colored binding with a black silk ribbon protruding from the top. I laid it on the table and found the title page. Vampire du Moyen Âge, Baron de Hajduk, Bucharest, 1886.
What do you want with this morbid rubbish?
Barley was gazing over my shoulder. School paper. The book was divided into chapters, as I remembered. Vampire de la Toscane, Vampire de la Normandie, and so on. I found the right one at last. Vampire de Provence et des Pyrénées. What had my father been looking for, poring over this first page of the chapter? Il y a aussi une légende. I leaned closer. Barley suddenly bent to follow the words, What he translated aloud, however, I had already taken in with a mental gasp.
There is also a legend that Dracula, noblest and most dangerous,